Chapter 17. They at no time saw any of the natives during the long tedium of the return voyage, which even on Dragon Wing consumed half the autumn, the desert creeping by slow, and their passage weary and hunted. They found tracks and signs enough in the mornings to know that they were watched. At the waterholes they drank swiftly and left what small offerings they could spare for the bunyips from their hunting, with the country grown still more spare and ungenerous in the waning of the year, and four dragons, one of rapacious appetite, to be fed. The beasts were all four of them thinner than Dorset liked before they reached at last the marker, the great monolith standing up out of the red desert with all its vegetation now burnt yellow by the sun, and began their turn for the coast.
"At least there will be the lake soon,"
Temeraire said wearily, lapping at another waterhole too shallow to put his muzzle in to drink properly. It was all their hope, that long fortnight's flying. Though they were yet only halfway home, they were now moving at a pace wholly different than during their first journey, flying straight instead of in pursuit of an unknown foe, and the prospect of the lake's refuge invited them onwards. When at last they sighted it in the distance as a faint, brilliant gleam stretching over the curve of the horizon, catching the sunset, Temeraire's wings quickened. All the dragon's pace increased, and they came landing by the shore not an hour later, to the stench of rotting fish and a shore crusted with a rim of pink-stained salt. The lake had receded to a long, narrow stretch of water. The water of the shrunken lake could not be drunk. It was become more salty than sea-water, pinkish in hue, and the dead fish floated half-eaten in clumped masses on its surface. The birds had deserted the shore. They managed to find a small water-hole sufficient to give the dragons a few swallows, although the requisite bribe drew down too much of their stores. In anticipation of the game at the lake, they had not paused so often for hunting. What little they had left they ate in silence, huddled close around their small fires. It was not merely inconvenience. The disappointment felt something of a parting slap, contemptuous from the wild back country, a reminder they were not welcome. And yet Lawrence felt little more so as they limped finally back into Sydney, a ragged and thinner band, and set down upon the promontory already once more overgrown in their long absence, grass and weeds and small prickly shrubs beginning to re-establish a hold. They arrived late, the Allegiance riding at anchor in the harbour, a small flotilla of merchant ships clustered nearer in to the shore. The sun hung low in the sky, throwing orange flame across the water, and at the mouth of the harbour, where it emptied out into the ocean, the light glittered on the hides of a dozen sea serpents, rising and plunging from the water at their play.
"The question only remains how it is to be done, not whether," Governor Macquarie said.
Bligh's replacement finally arrived a little while after Granby's second departure. In the intervening months of their journey, an elegant house had been raised on the spur of land overlooking the harbour, with a clear prospect from the office stretching all the way to the open ocean. Even a small rug lay upon the floor, and the furniture neatly joined. Lawrence and Granby stood raggedly out of place, and Rankin, for all his efforts, was not much better arrayed. They had not been afforded any opportunity to acquire new clothing. The summons had come last night, before they had even sent a runner to formally announce their arrival, and called them at first light to the governor's mansion to find the new governor waiting urgently, pacing across the floor of his study.
"I can see no reason to have them here,"
Bligh was saying scarcely under his breath, meaning MacArthur and Johnston, on the point of being shown in. MacArthur came across the room to shake Lawrence's hand.
"I find you have been a prodigiously long way, Captain," he said, throwing a look at the dust-stained and faded maps which had been laid out across the broad desk. "I am glad to see you returned safely."
Although there was perhaps some enthusiasm lacking, he and Johnston were ordered to England with Bligh to stand trial for the rebellion. Granby's return meant the Allegiance would sail at last, and she would make their natural transport.
"We must first, however, resolve what is to be done with these serpents. Their presence was ominous enough before the report we have had from you, gentlemen,"
Macquarie said, interrupting the private greetings and waving a hand to the chairs at his table. The serpents had not appeared alone. Another of the wide-winged dragons, not Shenli, had been sighted lately off the eastern coast, on one occasion not 30 miles distant. The serpents shortly thereafter had begun to make their sporadic appearances, evidently being trained upon some new harbour, near enough that in their frolics they from time to time came past Sydney. Shipping went still to and fro without incident. The serpents had not been incited against them, and seemed sufficiently well-fed that any natural inclination which might have led to attacks was suppressed. But this was scarcely much comfort to those who had seen the devastation they might easily wreak.
"They must be eradicated at once," Captain Willoughby said harshly,
his wooden leg stump stretched out awkwardly before his chair. He had insisted on accompanying them, though his injuries yet left his face grey and drawn with pain.
"We must trace them to their harbour and put them to the sword, them and their masters."
"Sir," Lawrence said, "we have already suffered a repulse from one attempt at taking a harbour so guarded, without sufficient preparation, and, Captain Willoughby must pardon me, without sufficient provocation for the consequences we court. Surely there can be no justification for spurring on a war with China, which, we now know, they have the means to carry against all our shipping. Even without the direction of intelligence, the serpents have been a constant peril to sailors before now. They need neither wind nor current in their favour to manoeuvre, and may strike wholly unexpected from below."
"Yes," Bligh said belligerently, "and there are a dozen of them outside our harbour this very moment. If the Chinese meant to teach us to respect their power, they have succeeded. If they meant to teach us fear, sir, they have failed, and will always do so."
"Hear, hear," Willoughby said, glaring at Lawrence, who compressed his lips at this ludicrous enthusiasm. He could scarcely fault Willoughby's courage, having already lost both an eye and a leg to the serpents, but his sense offered more to criticise. "The Navy gentlemen must forgive me," MacArthur said, "but I cannot help but wonder if we could not manage to think of something better to do with these fellows, who can, I gather, bring in 20 tons of goods from China to our shores in a month." Bligh might have purpled himself into an apoplexy in response. Macquarie raised a hand.
"If you please," he said.
He was quiet-spoken, and his face drawn in craggy but warm lines, with deep-set dark eyes, but he would not allow the possibility of negotiation.
"Our last orders by Commander Willoughby's report," he nodded to that gentleman, "are plain enough. We are not to tolerate any foreign encroachment on this continent. If efforts to dislodge them from this northern point have failed, that is only more cause to repulse them before they can establish another, nearer."
He was bent upon the eradication of the serpents. It was left only to discuss how it was to be done.
"Bombs must be our surest method for disposing of the creatures," Rankin said. "Delivered from aloft. If they have been trained to come to fish slops, we can easily bait them to their doom."
His suggestion was adopted with enthusiasm, despite the obvious difficulties of delivering bombs upon creatures which could plunge to the ocean depths, and whose size alone would make them difficult to kill. Willoughby applauded regardless, and Macquarie approved. Granby, who had more experience of aerial warfare than Rankin, whose former experience had been in the courier service, looked doubtful and said,
"We had better try it on one first, and at a good distance. If it drives them mad and it don't work, they might do for all the shipping in the port."
"Perhaps we ought to clear out some of the most valuable ships," MacArthur suggested, "if we will be dropping on them from above. I cannot see there is any need to keep the Allegiance in port for them to gnaw on her anchor cables."
There was something disingenuous in this proposal. He had already offered his services and Johnston's to arrange the manufacture of the bombs, which should give them excuse to postpone returning to England. But Riley had already once seen his ship nearly brought down by a sea serpent, and could not be said to be eager to repeat the experience. He was only too pleased to second the notion, and Governor Macquarie did not disagree. The plan of attack was agreed upon, the conference dismissed, not before Lawrence was given his long-delayed post. 3 letters bundled together from Jane, and another 2 for Temeraire, and 1 to be passed on to Thake. He put them in his pocket as they departed. MacArthur caught him at the door of the governor's office.
"I suppose they aren't to be reasoned with," MacArthur inquired, "these Chinamen, I mean. Do they wish to have us all thrown into the harbour and fed to the things?"
"I will beg you, sir, not to entertain the sort of absurd fancies which I have grown used to hearing from raw hands," Lawrence said, too exasperated to be courteous. "They are men like any others, and like any others possess full measure of folly and vice, but I cannot say their portion is greater than our own."
"Ah, well," MacArthur said, "then we may all go to the devil together."
He touched his hat and they parted, Lawrence to join Temeraire upon the promontory to share their letters. The correspondence did not go any length to reconciling him to the imminent attack, devastating almost equally in success or failure. Bonaparte had indeed made alliance with a Tswana, according to Jane. Put them on every transport he has in his pockets, and shipped them straight across the sea. 26 beasts delivered direct to Rio, 9 of them heavyweight, and 2 fire-breathers. You may guess what it was like, and I will spare you the particulars. They don't make comfortable reading, I will tell you. The Portuguese are howling for help, and we must do our best before they swallow their pride and bend the knee to France. But I have no notion how we will keep these fellows from tearing all the colony to rubble if we cannot persuade the Inca to take an interest. We must have Isquierca back at any price, and I would give an arm for one of those Japanese fellows, the waterspout makers. £10 million lost, they say, so far, in property. Ludicrous, ain't it? So far the Tswana only seem to care about the plantations and the slaves, but if they get a taste for war, as dragons will if you give them half a minute, and want more, you may be sure Boney will find some to offer them. Lawrence laid the letters down, bleakly. In such circumstances, to be opening another front against an enemy far better equipped than the Tswana to wage war upon their shipping seemed still nearer to madness. He sent Sifo for pen and paper, and began to add his own letter, however late and useless it should be, to advise Jane of these new circumstances and of his fears.